Welcome to Pap Talk, a podcast from Contemporary OBGYN, where we deliver expert insight, commentary, and more on emerging topics and trends for doctors in women's health.
Welcome, and thank you for joining us today. I'm Angie DeRosa, Senior Editor of Contemporary OBGYN. Today, we are joined by four experts in minimally invasive gynecologic surgery who will discuss V-Notes surgical technology. V-Notes is an acronym for Vaginal Natural Orifice Transluminal Endoscopic Surgery. This technology offers a minimally invasive alternative for performing various procedures, including hysterectomies, cystectomies, and oophorectomies, among others, where the vagina is used as the surgical access route, providing access to the uterus, fallopian tubes, and ovaries. Joining me today are Dr. Jan Einarsson, who is Deputy Medical Editor of Contemporary OBGYN, and of course, Director of the Division of Minimally Invasive Gynecologic Surgery at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and a professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive biology at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Einarsson will lead and moderate the discussion. We are also joined by three other experts who together, and they can correct me if I'm wrong, and I did the math, have performed several hundred V-Notes procedures combined. Dr. Brandi Harden practices in Spartanburg, South Carolina. She is affiliated with Spartanburg Medical Center and is on the Medical Executive Committee of the Ambulatory Surgery Center of Spartanburg. Dr. Harden currently performs about 10 V-Notes procedures per month. Dr. Grover May is the managing partner of a large OBGYN private practice in Johnson City, Tennessee. He was an early adopter of single incision laparoscopic surgery and has provided contemporary MIGS techniques to his patients for over 20 years. Dr. May began performing V-Notes in 2019 and has performed more than 100 V-Notes procedures. And Dr. Thomas Pittman is board certified in obstetrics, gynecology, female pelvic medicine, and reconstructive surgery, and has more than 25 years experience. Dr. Pittman currently practices in South Haven, Mississippi, where he specializes in urogynecology and minimally invasive surgical techniques. He has performed over 700 single-site laparoscopic procedures and has combined this technique with his vaginal surgical experience to perform V-Notes procedures for his patients. Thank you all for being here today. We know that our readership will get great value from your expertise. And now I will turn it over to Dr. Einarsson.
Well, thank you very much. And thank you all for agreeing to participate in this and share your expertise. The reason I wanted to do this is because I think V-Notes has received a lot of interest, and there's a lot of enthusiasm about this technology and technique. And I think a lot of OBGYNs are interested in knowing more on how to do this. So I wanted to try to have the conversation fairly practical, if you don't mind. So to try to, you know, basically think about the OBGYN specialists out there that would be interested in doing this, focus the conversation in a way that's as practical for them as possible. So I wanted to basically ask some questions and get you all of your feedback and I guess we'll start with the patient selection for V-Notes. What patients do you find are good candidates for this approach?
So I think, you know, that starts out different than it ends up. But when I first started, I looked for candidates who were very similar to a vaginal hysterectomy patient, because quite honestly, I felt like that I had a relatively abandoned the technique of vaginal hysterectomy in favor of my laparoscopic instruments. And like Dr. Pittman, I do a lot of single site cases. So I felt like I was already offering a very minimally invasive technique. But that said, I found that doing vaginal surgery, as the evidence suggests, it is actually even more minimally invasive than my single incision cases were. So when I looked for candidates early on, I looked for ones who had prolapse, who had small uteri, who were multiparous, no prior C-sections, things of that nature. What I found as time went on is that a lot of that was unnecessary. And the real rate limiting step for me is, can I perform a safe colpotomy and obtain access? And beyond that point, it becomes quite a bit easier to perform the procedure, and is not at all like a vaginal hysterectomy once you place the laparoscopic port and begin to operate laparoscopically. So really the limitations for me about picking a patient selection are when I select a patient who I can perform colpotomies in.
I agree. The idea of waiting until you have the ideal patient, when you adopt this procedure, I think that's a mistake. You just need to evaluate each patient individually. And if they've got an accessible vaginal apex that you can do that colpotomy, proceed. Three of my first five cases were over 500 grams. So, you know, this technique is adaptable and very exciting.
So I would say that from my standpoint, everybody wants to pick the easiest and the best cases first, but if you don't start doing them and doing them often enough, the volume of doing them is more important than the type of case you're doing. So very quickly, I was at the point where I was like, I'm going to consider everybody for V-notes, and then I'm going to exclude people based on certain criteria. So I always start out with the approach of, I think this is a V-notes candidate. Let me decide whether there's anything happening that makes me think they're not a V-notes candidate, like vaginal access. But I think vaginal surgery begets vaginal surgery. So the more vaginal surgery you do, the more comfortable you get with it, and the more things you become comfortable doing. You have to have some successes so you don't abandon it at the beginning, though.
Well, that's a good actually segue. Dr. Harden, you can answer that first. What are your contraindications? Like, where wouldn't you do this? I mean, you wouldn't do this on every case, would you? I mean, or do this pretty much for all your patients?
Well, since I started doing them at the beginning of March, I have, and I don't do robotic surgery, and I've never done single site surgery. I basically switched from complete laparoscopic assisted vaginal hysterectomy to V-notes. Several of my partners are robotic surgeons, but since I adopted this, I have sent one patient to them for robotic surgery, and it had to do with a possible borderline cancer that I did not want to rupture through the vagina that was a large mass. Otherwise, I have attempted every single other hysterectomy since March through V-notes and have only had to convert one patient, and that was the patient who had a 2,400 gram uterus. But I was able to do most of it through the V-notes and had to do a fan and steel incision to get the actual fibroid uterus out. So in the end, she had an 80% V-notes and then a fan and steel incision versus a midline vertical. So I quickly decided to make an attempt. There's not a lot to lose, frankly, if you're in the operating room and you make an attempt and you know your limitations. If you can't get in posteriorly, if you can't be safe anteriorly or gain access at least posteriorly to put the device in, then there's no harm in abandoning the approach at that time. So I'm more of the approach of, really, unless you have an absolute reason you would not try it, then I say, try it and see what happens. Each time you'll probably get a little bit farther. And if you have to put a scope in their stomach, that's not the end of the world.
I agree, and something that Grover taught me early on is that, you know, we need to counsel our patients that we want to proceed in the least invasive way possible, and you don't lock yourself in to this is the way we're going to do it. I explained to them that, you know, I'm going to evaluate you under anesthesia, and plan A is the V-notes. I think that's the best way to proceed, But if for some reason I feel like that we need to go above, we'll go above to the single site. And I did my training in April, and I've done 90% of my hysterectomies now, V-notes since then, for that very thing. You go in there with the idea that you're going to do the most minimally invasive procedure, counsel them beforehand, and just proceed. And the patients do so well.
I agree with that in general, but when I do counsel patients, if I know that I need the manual dexterity and 3D visualization of the robot for, say, deep endometriosis in the anterior compartment, particularly, or in the pelvic neural anatomy, you know, if I'm going to be working in those spaces doing neural resections, I probably wouldn't start with a V-notes approach at this skill level today. I would either do those robotically or refer them to someone who has a high volume of that type of procedure. But those, as Dr. Harden alluded to, are pretty infrequent for my particular practice. So I think that you have to think through what you see in each different area. Some surgeons are kind of bread and butter OBGYN practices, and others are referral based, where they're getting those very difficult deep endo cases where they have to sometimes resect bowel or ureter. But my real thing is, I guess, if I can make the colpotomy, again, I'd like to keep it as simple as I can. If they've had pelvic radiation and I know they're going to have a fused rectovaginal septum, if they've had a history of that is a known rectovaginal disease. But again, advanced pelvic surgeons, like people who are often in the FPMRS, you know, areas, they're kind of more comfortable than some OBGYN, standard OBGYN training, where maybe they don't have the volume of that. I've also noticed that sometimes prolapse can make it difficult because it's already out of the body. And so you have to kind of work around that. But surgeons who do that a lot have found that it actually simplifies prolapse. So I hope we'll get to talk about that a little bit later. But for me, it's is the anterior and or posterior cul-de-sac completely fused or obliterated? And if I can get in on either one, I really can proceed with better visualization. And as Dr. Harden alluded to, and Dr. Pittman, if you have to go above, you're converting from a most minimally invasive technique to a slightly more invasive technique, but it still remains within the spectrum of mixed surgery.
Okay, so basically, let's say you take someone to the OR and you feel that there's a complete obliteration of the anterior and posterior cul-de-sac, then maybe the plan would change. But other than that, you could probably, at least in terms of hysterectomy, take on most cases. Is that what I'm hearing kind of here?
Yes, most cases. Now, I will assess that in the office with a rectovaginal exam in most patients, and I will often pull on the cervix with the tenaculum if they've had prior C-sections to see if the abdominal wall tints inward. Sometimes I will look at ultrasound dynamically to help me assess those planes. But those are all just tips and tricks we've learned to try to make sure we don't find out in the OR. Yes.
What about other surgeries? Are you guys doing myomectomies or ovarian cystectomies or other procedures through this approach?
And adnexal surgeries, tubes and ovaries. I have not done a myomectomy as yet. Again, just an early adopter. I've done 30 of the VA and H's, and of course, also uterosacral suspensions. That's been a big thing for me because you can see the ureter so well, and you know that your stitch placement is well away from the ureter, and you can pull on the suture and make sure the ureter doesn't kink. And to have that kind of reassurance is moving me away from the sacrospinal suspension, you know, as much as I was previously. So I'm really pleased with the uterosacral suspension.
So maybe you can, if it would be great if you could each provide the audience with some practical tips on the initial entry and setup. What's the most challenging step, and how do you sort of do that? Because it sounds like once you're in, and you can sort of start operating. But what do you have any tips and tricks to how to get this started, get the colpotomy and initial entry done?
So I'll speak to that. So first thing is obviously patient position. These patients don't have to be as far down off the exam table or the operating table as a traditional TVH just because of the retractors you're using. So I think that helps them kind of postoperatively as well. But making sure that they're centered on the table, that their bottom's kind of at the very end of the table. I always start with a little bit of Trendelenburg. I'm injecting more circumferentially around the cervix than I used to for my standard LAVHs. I usually use about 20 cc's of a vasoconstrictor, whether that's lidocaine with epi or Pitresin. I also went from a straight direct entry technique colpotomy to circumscribing and really taking kind of a wet, slightly moist open Ratec and advancing all the way around. And that kind of helps you find posteriorly with an allis where you really can kind of tug on it and see that it tents off of the cervix. So I feel like that makes it a little easier to make the posterior colpotomy, and making a big colpotomy is a really important step because the more narrow your colpotomy, the harder it is to get your ring placement in there, and then you'll have the ring pop out. And that I find has been the thing that frustrated me the most in the early stages, was not the actual practical part of doing the hysterectomy, was getting the ring in the right place, seated properly, and not having it come out and having to redo that multiple times. So big colpotomies, tagging peritoneum to the posterior cervicovaginal fascia so that you don't separate between those layers. I found those to be the best things as far as colpotomies go.
And that tagging also helps with the ring placement, I think. That's a big help. Once you get that ring seated properly, it makes the rest of the case so much easier.
You know, in the last few years, since we came back and started teaching this, I found that there's a kind of a bifurcation of what that rate limiting step is. What's the most challenging step that you mentioned? And for many surgeons in America, I think it really is the anterior colpotomy. I think our residency training programs are struggling to get vaginal hysterectomy numbers up, and the residents that are trained in the more recent years have had difficulty with getting adequate volume to feel very confident with colpotomy. Likewise, there are numbers throughout the nation of surgeons who have relatively abandoned the vaginal route for the primary as their primary route, despite, you know, the evidence that ACOG continues to champion that it should be our first route is vaginal surgery, and that laparoscopy would be an acceptable alternative if it's not feasible. So that said, I think number one, the first step is if you're comfortable with an anterior colpotomy, the next most challenging thing is placing the access devices. And so these rings that we typically use, these VPATH type rings that go in and roll down to allow us to develop a pneumoperitoneum, can be difficult to place if you haven't been trained. So to overcome that, I would say attend a training course like those that are sponsored by the iNotes through Dr. Bacala, and Applied Medical offers those, which we are all faculty for that. But they do teach these techniques of how do you place a ring. And they have also generated some techniques as well as introducers that have made it a lot easier for surgeons to overcome this challenging step. Dr. Hardin alluded to it, but making a larger colpotomy is necessary to get these rings to stay in and to get them placed where you can establish a pneumoperitoneum. So the vaginal portion of the surgery has its own rate limiting step or challenging step. And I think it's anterior colpotomy. It's no different than any other vaginal hysterectomy case. It's what, when I train a resident, it's what I worry about the most is teaching them how to do that. Posterior colpotomy, most people don't struggle with that. Clamping uterus sacral ligaments and ligating, you know, are things that are pretty easy for us to do. But once you get past that, placing the ring is a little different than the technique that you would use if you continued on with clamp, cut, tie, or even using energy sources for progressing in your vaginal cases.
So a question about the learning curve. How many cases in your experience do you think you need to do until you're comfortable and you sort of, this is sort of part of your routine? What would you say?
So learning theory says that the sooner you put into practice something that you just learned, but a lot, as a corollary to that, one thing that I've found is that the more frequently you have repetition. So what I found was 10 cases in a month or so is plenty to get a learning curve up there. That said, if you do 10 cases in a year, I don't know that it's the same. So I think it's a little bit of how many cases, but also over how short of a time period. Would you all agree with that?
I would. 10 is a reasonable number. I felt like by the time I finished my 10th case that I was very confident, able to proceed in situations that I was questioning whether I would, prior to that, fatigue, the shoulder and the arm fatigue, with prolonged laparoscopic cases.
So I would say at the beginning, when you're first doing them, there's a balance. You don't want to just do one your first day necessarily, but you probably don't want to do four your first day because you're going to run through challenges. Your OR staff has never seen this setup. They've never seen one done. People will be scratching their heads saying, I'm not sure I can even visualize this. So there's some of that is a learning curve to get past as well. But the first day I ever did them, I did three, and I scheduled them in the order of what I thought was going to be the easiest, then the medium case, and then the harder of the three cases. And really at the end of that day, I felt so much better than at the beginning of that day. So I think it's important to do, I think 10 is a reasonable number in, 4 to 6 weeks. Sometimes that's hard, there's ebbs and flows, but I think it's important that the first few days you do them, you do more than one that day.
I would also add that when we were teaching single site, I taught single site for over 10 years, and we had about a 3% adoption rate. But when we began teaching VNotes, there's 70 or 80% adoption rate. And I believe what happens is it translates more to the skills that surgeons already possess. And it's more of a matter of changing the way we look at anatomy. So it's been very exciting to see how few cases it takes to master it when you're teaching surgeons who are already good surgeons. They just simply need to rethink how they view anatomy and access. But the generation of the tissue planes of the traction and countertraction in order to interact with tissue planes comes very easy once they establish access.
How do you bill for this? Is this billed as a vaginal hysterectomy or an LAVH? Or what's the right billing rate code for this type of surgery?
So we're currently billing under the LAVH codes. And of course, there's the less than and greater than 250 grams. Right. Same thing for the 58661 for salpingectomy. So it's still a laparoscopic case. If I move my ports to the left upper quadrant, that doesn't alter whether I'm doing a laparoscopic hysterectomy or not. And likewise, it's been our position that a LAVH is the same as a VALH, a vaginally assisted laparoscopic hysterectomy. When you read the code book, that seems to apply. So that's what we've used. The only other option within the coding manual that I can find would be using a specials code. I do believe that there will become its own code over time as we continue to develop those. And that will be helpful for continuing our research into how we do this, because we can then use claims data.
You guys agree? So look, you're nodding. So what energy device do you like to use when you're doing, for example, your hysterectomy? Do you have a preference and why?
I personally like to use the Voyant. I do my hysterectomies at two different places. I do them at the main campus, and I've recently, this summer, started doing a fair number at our ambulatory surgery center. We have different energy contracts. So the ambulatory center has Voyant. The hospital has LigaSure. I prefer the Voyant because it's got a 360-degree handle, so I find that to be much easier than having to, with the LigaSure, roll 270 and then roll back. I think the Voyant sticks a little bit less. I like that they are always they're always kind of trying to learn and make the energy technique and technology better by assessing all of that data that they get from every use of a Voyant. I think whatever energy device you're comfortable with is what energy device you should start with. There are a few exceptions. There are some energy devices that just, I don't think, are well suited to working around the ring retractor that's plastic in the plastic bag that actually kind of the cellophane type bag that stretches, they get too hot, they arc too much, things like the Thunderbeat. I think those are too aggressive of an energy device for that technique.
Yeah, I agree. I used the Thunderbeat primarily for my single site to do the colpotomy, and I thought that I would use the same device for the VA and H's, but you're working in a more confined space. It generates more smoke or more vapor than the Voyant. And again, the heat comment you made as far as melting the plastic if you get too close. The blunt-tipped Voyant to me is perfect because working in that confined space and walking up and down the tissue to position the uterus out of the pelvis and away from the pelvic sidewall structures, you can use that blunt-tipped Voyant. This is a blunt-tipped grasper, and it works very well.
And I think advanced bipolar is clearly the best energy choice for using for V-notes. And, you know, if you don't have advanced bipolar using standard bipolar, the Voyant is a very advanced bipolar and that sort of thing. Many places have had great success with other vendors like Ligasure, but I would say that when you start getting into harmonic techniques, harmonic energy, that's probably the one that has the greatest issues. As you get into doing V-notes, and you'll roll down a ring retractor, and that every roll of the ring retractor places lateral force. So essentially, in the right hands, you can probably use about any energy source, but understanding that the more tension you have it on, the more issue. And so when someone is first learning, it's very simple to presume that there's no tension on your plane, but the ring itself is creating some, which is why I think that an advanced bipolar helps. And those that generate less smoke, less steam, tend to work better when you're in that confined space in the pelvis. So I would echo those same sentiments that they have as far as the Voyant being primarily my go-to. The secondary, any other advanced bipolar. And then third, I use standard bipolar. Sometimes I'll just use a regular old bipolar if I'm at a surgery center where I don't have access to those things.
And if you think about the proportion of cases that you're doing V-notes on, maybe two-pronged answer, hysterectomies and other types of surgeries, what proportion are you doing with V-notes? And if you're doing other approaches, what approaches do you use when you're not using V-notes on those cases? Are you doing laparoscopic, robotic, open? What kind of, I'm just trying to get a feel for your practice and the place of V-notes in it.
I've only done a few myomectomies through V-notes. I did an anterior and a posterior, and they have to be positioned in just the right spot. But it's possible to do those things. Ectopics, probably 100%. Ectopics are one of the easiest cases to do. Appendectomies are easy to do. So those would be approaching 100%. When you're starting to look at just standard V-notes hysterectomy, and unless they have a low cervical fibroid or their cul-de-sac is at ease, that's my go-to now, because the procedure gets easier as I get farther along, and the extraction is easier because the access port is much larger. So I would approach 95% of hysterectomies. Now, when I do have complicated cases like deep endometriosis, that's probably where I look more towards robotics. I do single incision if someone declines to be operated on through the vagina, or if I need to be able to access the anterior compartment first. The anterior to the uterus is probably the hardest for me to see.
I don't do robotics at all. I do either vaginal, now with the V-notes, or single site laparoscopy, and then rarely an open case. As far as reconstructive procedures, I'll do the sacrospinal suspension with a 4-point fixation with biologic graft. But with the V-notes now, this uterosacral suspension aspect has really expanded things. I'm really excited.
And I do 99% of mine through V-notes. If I can't do it through V-notes and they need robotic surgery, I refer them to one of my partners who does robotic surgery. And I've just had that single patient with the 2400 gram fibroids that I had to open.
Actually, speaking of pelvic reconstructive surgery, I've seen some early reports of people doing xacocobapexes with bee notes. Have you seen any of those reports? Do you have any experience with that? I know that's a very sort of new thing.
Dr. Yaming Guan in Houston's doing those, and I've seen the technique. It's challenging. One of the things I love about V-Notes is that people are developing the utilization of this way of looking at surgery as a hybrid to be able to take other surgeries we're doing and convert them to a vaginal approach. That said, I think that sacrocolpopexies with mesh placement are very challenging and advanced. They're still in their infancy as far as developing a technique, and are probably, it's going to be a few years before we see that really take on mainstream. But to Dr. Pittman's point, a lot of people are finding that getting high level one support at pelvic relaxation is much easier from a vaginal approach. And so I have started to do a lot more sacrocolpopexy, high uterus sacral ligament suspensions, where previously I was probably doing more sacrospinous when I was doing vaginal, and I was using robotic sacrocolpopexy as another technique for my pelvic support, and not utilizing one of the better procedures, which I would argue, and Dr. Pittman could probably say more, that's your field, but I would argue is the sacrospinous, high uterus sacral ligament suspension. Sorry, I always get this backwards.
Yeah, I was shied away from the uterus sacral suspension because I was so concerned about the ureter. So did almost exclusively the sacrospinous suspensions, and I thought they have amazing results. But when I started doing these uterus sacral suspensions, the high uterus sacral suspensions with the V-notes, and you go to tie that suspension suture, it is really impressive. It's very, very effective.
So what prompted you guys to start offering V-notes to your patients? What was the aha moment where you said, like, look, this is great. What was the motivation to do it?
So I was approached actually by one of the reps from Applied Medical and said, would you be interested in learning this new technique? I think you'd be good at it. And they sent me some videos, and I said, sure, let's learn it. And then I went to a class in January and was really, really impressed with it. And I thought, well, gosh, you know, my LAVH patients do really well. I can do those pretty quickly. But gosh, what if I could do it without any incisions and without all the rigmarole in the operating room, where you start vaginally, go abdominally, come back vaginally, go back abdominally. And that felt like just a lot of extra stuff. It feels more efficient in the operating room to start vaginally, stay vaginally. The amount of instruments you need is probably one third or less of the number of instruments that they would pull for an LAVH. So from my standpoint, I want a new pack developed just for my V-notes. They haven't done it yet at my facility, but that's what I want. I don't need 17 Alice clamps, you know? So I like that it was just exactly what we needed, minimizing the waste. You know, we use less suture. There's just so much that I think is so much better than all of that. And the patients, you know, you do a few of them, you see how well they do, and you're like, God, that'll make you an adopter really quickly.
Most definitely. Yeah, I was similar. They reached out to me because I had such a high volume of the single site TLHs. And, you know, you get out of training and you think, you know, I'm doing the least invasive thing that I can do, either vaginal or LAVH or TLH. This is the first time I've been excited since I finished my residency about something. And I hope you can see how excited I am, because the patients just do so well. They come in, they're so happy, so thankful for the ability to get back to work in a week and resume normal activity so quickly. And they use so much less narcotics post-op. I mean, 3 pills post-op typically, and that's all they use. I mean, it is just so impressive. And the transition from the single site laparoscopy to this V-notes has been pretty smooth. So I'm excited.
I've always been interested in offering my patients the least invasive route. And interestingly, I've had a passion for teaching doctors in practice. I like the interactions with other colleagues who have excellent ideas and can share those back with me. But over that time, it's afforded me the ability to make relationships with others because of those teaching opportunities. And so somebody, I think it was Lee Cohen at Applied Medical, who had said, you know, Dr. Bacalant, and I think he's friends with you as fellow MIGS director, but, you know, he's over in Belgium. And so I come to hear about him through my teaching experiences. During that time, I thought, why would I want to do that? And shortly after that, I had the opportunity to speak to the Southern OBGYN Society about how do you approach hysterectomy in the morbidly obese. In the South, we have a lot of biscuit poison patients, and so I have to think of how we do that. And I took the unpopular but realistic perspective that you should do it in the manner that you're best trained to handle that. And so for some, it's laparoscopic, for some, it's open, and for some, it's vaginal. And people who supported the data reminded me that vaginal is the answer if you look at studies. That said, I hadn't been doing that many. And so it convicted me that we talk about evidence-based medicine, but this is an area where the evidence clearly supports it, and yet I was not offering it. So I got convicted of the need to re-engage vaginal surgery and started visiting with Dr. Bacalant in Belgium, learned the technique, and the aha moment for me was when he placed the ring in and showed me that you don't have to do an anterior colpotomy. You can develop a pneumoperitoneum and do that laparoscopically even. I realized then that I could overcome the colpotomy fear that I had. And now it's not an issue, but early on, that was just one of those ahas. Those first few patients came back, and the testimonials they gave kept me going after I tried this new technique. But it was the 33rd patient who I'll never forget that changed my life. She was 685 pounds and 5'2", and she had a large abdominal mesh and a prior colostomy and an operative report on her chart that said, do not go back in this pelvis, essentially, or you will be in her bowels again. And she had had 3 prior vaginal births. And I remembered I had said, the evidence says you should try this vaginally. I didn't believe I could do her case vaginally from her other challenges, but we were able to do that with a V-notes approach vaginally. And I'm sure there's some surgeons who could have done it vaginally, but this patient convicted me that we need to really explore this and learn it.
So about the data, I know that this is a fairly, you know, it's a fairly new procedure, and I'm aware of some, there's, I think, 1 randomized trial, and there's some other observational data. What does the data look like in terms of comparing V-notes with vaginal hysterectomy, like pure vaginal hysterectomy and or robotic or laparoscopic hysterectomy? Like, what's your read on that currently?
Well, there's currently... there's good evidence for hysterectomy. There's level 1B and adnexectomy with the classic HALON trial and the notable trial, which was looking at adnexectomy. And those were double-blind RCTs. They were small, single-center trials performed by an experienced surgeon. And so that evidence exists to tell us that it is at least as efficacious, if not better in some ways than standard laparoscopic hysterectomy. To my knowledge, there's not a direct head-to-head versus vaginal hysterectomy. And I think that's data that those of us who are engaged in this field want to see developed. This is still in its infancy, and I think that is a need for those of us who are performing it to continue to do that. But the data is coming out more and more, especially in some other countries where they've engaged it quicker, in Europe and in China, places like that. But the data that we do have suggests that it's as good, if not better, but it is definitely, we have efficacy studies that are at a high level in terms of the quality of data that they've produced.
You guys agree with that?
Yeah, I agree. I'm excited to see a head-to-head. You know, anecdotally, when you think about the techniques, you know, with vaginal hysterectomy, the traction is, you know, downward constantly. And I thank the Lord every day made me a man and not a woman, because I can't imagine the discomfort of pulling those ligaments down like that. But with the V-notes, the movement is out of the pelvis. You're actually pushing the specimen up and medially constantly during the procedure. So you're not really pulling down on those ligaments. So I hypothesize that the pain is going to be much less than a typical vaginal hysterectomy for a large uterus.
I totally agree with that. I think there is a lot to be said about the how much tissue manipulation there is involved in traditional vaginal surgery, just clamp cut tie surgery versus this. The traction you put on it is really minimal, and then you're not strangulating vascular pedicles like you do when you tie things off with a suture. I think it's probably going to be less scarring to people because it's probably less inflammatory, just like traditional laparoscopy, taking out ectopics versus, you know, leaving Vicryl or Chromic in there and how inflammatory that can be. But as a woman who's had two babies and I've had a C-section and I've had a vaginal delivery, when the ligaments are an issue for sure. I mean, I think Dr. Pittman hits the nail on the head. I think when you're not really pulling and yanking on those ligaments, and I think not having the metal retractors in during a vaginal hysterectomy, the Deaver under the bladder where somebody's blindly retracting for you and they can't see and they're really putting a lot of torque and bruising the bladder, and how long that weighted speculum sits in the back wall of the vagina, and do you need a sidewall retractor in there? I think there's a lot to be said for that.
So also I will say there are some meta-analysis that have been published. There was one just last year in December, actually, of 2020 in the Journal of Clinical Medicine. I'm trying to remember the author of that. But that was a systematic review and meta-analysis comparing hysterectomy by V-notes versus laparoscopic hysterectomy for benign indications. And it showed that there was equal efficacy for operating time and hospitalization and estimated blood loss with no differences in complication rates, readmission rates, or pain scores at 24 hours. So those types of data exist to say that at least it's as good as TLH. And I don't think that we're at the point where we have the head-to-head comparison to vaginal. But what I would say is we're not doing just vaginal nowadays. That's why we got away from it, was we could see and do better. So I know we've had several studies that compare those, just not to vaginal surgery. There's other, I think Steineman in the British Journal of Surgery published a meta-analysis of the hybrid notes versus lap surgery. And I know there's some in other areas of you know, that you could extrapolate from, but we definitely are in need of data. And so as this rolls out, there's a little over 300 surgeons that are trained in the US that I'm aware of. And I think that we're planning more data to get more robust data in the near future.
And I think Dr. Harden, you allude to this, but you can see everything, and not just you, but everybody in the OR can see, right, that you're doing, which I think is a big, that's I think is one of the reasons why vaginal surgery or vaginal hysterectomy hasn't taken off as much, is because when we're doing laparoscopic cases, everybody in the OR can see. You can teach hundreds of people what you're doing. They're seeing exactly what you're seeing, as opposed to with vaginal surgery, it's harder for people to see what's going on. But with this, you're seeing what the surgeon is seeing. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah. Yep. And I can do it with one less assistant as well. I mean, so that's, you know, another level of efficiency, one less person in the operating room.
Right. Well, running the camera doesn't have to be trained as much either, because you know, with laparoscopic surgery, the person who's running that camera can be a rate limiting factor. When you're working in such a small space with a 30 degree scope, it's pretty much minimal manipulation of the camera for the whole case.
And cost is one of those things that I think we're starting to look at nationwide about the, you know, what's the ethical nature of how much do we spend on a patient, you know. And so you mentioned it earlier, Dr. Harden, that, you know, the trays don't require much. And so when I started doing these, patients or staff was telling me, we don't need that many instruments. And so they quickly made a new tray and their turnover time reduced. So my human cost, anybody could set this case up. It didn't require a special knowledge of equipment. It really didn't require a lot of time for sterilization. So where I could previously perform three major cases in a day, 3 to 4. I can easily do 5 to 6 now. And the actual cost of instrumentation was lower because 90% of it or more is reusable. And that's huge.
So one specific scenario in terms of a large uterus where you have to do an extraction, it won't fit out intact. Are you guys doing contained extraction? And if so, is it easy to do in this way? How do you accomplish that if you're doing contained extraction?
I am doing containment. It's very easy to place because the angle, again, it changes everything when you're looking from the bottom up. So you can place your bag under the specimen and it sits on top of you. You're not having to lift a heavy specimen up to you. You're having to get the bag under a heavy specimen because you're starting on the bottom. So it's actually easier to bag. And I use the Applied ACES bag because it's easy to kind of pull a tether around and get it. It just fits well in the port. I can then roll it down. But the even easier thing is any laparoscopic port I've ever made is smaller than any vagina I've ever placed a port in. And so the extraction technique is so much easier when I have that sheath, the ring inside the peritoneum all the way out. It gives me the maximum diameter. So bagging it is easy. And then extracting it is reduced in time because the size of the opening that I'm pulling it through.
Yeah, and I would say to Dr. May's point, even patients that are nulliparous patients, it's still a much bigger opening than anything laparoscopic you would put through their abdominal wall. So when I've had a big fibroid uterus on a nulliparous patient, I've still been able to bag it. And that bag gives you the extra protection against the other bag. So you really are almost double bagged when you bring it down to the opening.
Yeah, I agree. And it's surprising the size uterus you can remove without morcellating. I did a 704 gram uterus and was able to get it without morcellating through that larger port.
And the notable trial showed that there was less need for bags because they fit. I don't know that the Halon trial covered that, but the notable trial actually mentioned that one of their endpoints was less need for using those bags simply because it fit without fit already, you know, because you already have a larger diameter.
Gotcha. Well, we're coming close to the end, but the last question really is if you could provide any sort of tips and tricks for the reader or listener to make the transition to VNotes easier. We probably talked about most of them already, but if there's any additional tips and tricks that you have that can help people start doing these procedures.
Well, one thing I would say is that most people that are learning these procedures at the courses that I've gone to help teach are people who have not just gotten out of residency in the last year or two. They're people who have been doing procedures for a long time. And just like Dr. Pittman said, it's the first time he's been excited about something. It's the first time I've been excited about something too. So remembering why you're doing it, and that it's always hard to learn something new. It's always uncomfortable to learn something new. When you're a resident, everything is new to you. You've got the backup of attendings. This puts you in a different kind of frame of mind. Recognizing that you're going to be uncomfortable, it's okay to be uncomfortable, realizing that it's a learning curve, but that it's a steep learning curve for most people. I think that's the best thing. I think your approach, because you're going to have frustrations anytime you use a new instrument in the operating room, anytime you have a new scrub tech in the operating room, there's frustrations. But recognizing there'll be frustrations, and they're just that, they're just frustrations, and most of them are pretty easy to overcome. I think that's the biggest thing, is kind of your approach to them. You're probably not going to love it the first time you do it. You may say, that was too frustrating, I had to put the ring in 4 different times. But every time it gets a little bit better. And I think that's my thing, is the kind of where your mindset is when you start.
Certainly, and the frustrations you mentioned, they're going to come, but the patient doesn't know about any of that. When you see that patient back and they are so happy and they did so well, don't even think they had surgery, those frustrations, the memories of your frustrations go away. Because it was worth it. So that's where I would just tell everyone it's worth it to give this a shot, have an open mind. Of course, patient safety is first, and you're going to be frustrated on those first few cases, but just keep going. And the patient feedback will keep feeding you and motivating you.
And I would say, you know, understand the surgical geometry. I'm excited about this as well for the first time in a long time. When Harry Rich first showed us that we could use a laparoscope and some instruments that we were doing tubules with to take out a uterus, it was groundbreaking and a watershed moment in our careers that generated many, many other techniques, tricks, including the robotic techniques that we do today so much. You know, and I feel like that this is that next watershed moment where we're now looking at currently utilized techniques. We've always been vaginal surgeons. It's what makes us different from general surgeons. It's one of those things that's very unique to the field of obstetrics and gynecology. And so to that end, I think when you remember those but see the anatomy from a different perspective, you have to understand the surgical geometry, and it's an unfamiliar access route and plane. So to that end, attend a course where you can network with other surgeons, develop relationships and proctorships until you feel confident. Lean on those people who've walked down that path before to work with you and hold your hand getting started. And I know I'm willing to do so, and I think I can speak for Dr. Pittman and Dr. Hardin as well, because we've had this discussion. We want to help others do that. So start with easier pathology. Understand that you're going from the least invasive route to a more invasive route. So there's no harm in starting vaginally and converting to laparoscopy any more than there was starting a laparoscopic case and converting it to an LAVH, you know, before. It's just reversing the order of events. So I believe that those tips would help anyone who's starting out become more successful.
Great. Well, I think that's, I think we've covered this quite well now. So I really want to thank you again for sharing all your expertise and spending this time with us.
Thanks for listening to this episode of PAP Talk. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.